from Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
You know, the conventional wisdom in Washington is if there's a scandal, money's
turn the, turn the cooler off.
Republican. If it's sex, it's a Democrat. But in actuality, it's the complete opposite. With Republicans, it's sex, and with Democrats, it's money.
Sex, lies, and politics. The Naked Truth. Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler magazine, talks about the Bush administration, the war on civil liberties, women's rights, and his famous offers to pay for dirt on politicians he views as hypocrites. And Frank Big Black Smith, one of the leaders of the Attica prison uprising, dies at the age of 70.
I'm telling you, my name is being called. Where's Big Black? Where's Big Black? Get up, Black, get up. And he busted me with a nigger stick, pickaxe, and got a 38 in his hand. And I gets up, and he bam, in my side, in my back, and made me run with my hand on my head over to the side. And before I got over there, two, three more correction officers with him now, and everybody's hitting me.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Officials revealed yesterday most of the information that led to Sunday's increase in the terror threat level around specific financial institutions is largely based on surveillance al-Qaeda carried out over 3 years ago, before the September 11th attacks. One senior law enforcement official told the Washington Post, quote, "There's nothing right now that we're hearing that's new. Why did we go to this level? I still don't know that." On Sunday, the Department of Homeland Security warned of attacks against five sites: the International Monetary Fund and World Bank headquarters in Washington, the New York Stock Exchange and Citigroup Center in New York, the Prudential Financial Building in Newark as well. Yesterday, security at all the sites were markedly increased. A counterterrorism official told the Washington Post, quote, "Most of the information's very dated, but you clearly have targets with enough specificity that pushed it over the edge. You've got the Republican convention coming up, the Olympics, the elections. I think there was a feeling," he said, "that we should err on the side of caution, even if it's not clear that anything is new." While both the New York Times and Washington Post have major pieces today highlighting that the intelligence is 3 years old, Bush administration officials Sunday gave reporters no hint that the threat was so old. The U.S. uncovered the documents last month. In its Monday editions, the New York Times reported al-Qaeda may have carried out test run attacks in, quote, recent days. But today, the New York Times reveals that officials in New Jersey had misspoken, and that no such test runs are believed to have occurred. President Bush said yesterday he supports creation of a new national intelligence director and a national counterterrorism center. Key recommendations of the commission that investigated the attacks of September 11, 2001. His backing, however, is conditional. The intelligence chief would not have authority over budgets, hiring and firing, and would not be stationed in the White House, counter to suggestions of the commission. The director would not be a member of the president's cabinet. Executive Director of the 9/11 Commission, Philip Zelikow, warned about Bush's proposal. He told PBS, quote, "If Congress takes the shell of this idea and then dilutes the powers so that it looks like they've done it, but they haven't really done it, then you'll have another bureaucratic layer." Bush opposed the creation of the commission, and three members of his cabinet, including Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, have opposed creation of the intelligence post. The Los Angeles Times is reporting that Iraq's top criminal court is investigating allegations that Ahmed Chalabi's nephew, Salem Chalabi, threatened an Iraqi official days before the man was assassinated in late May. The finance ministry official was killed, was investigating whether the Chalabi family had illegally seized hundreds of pieces of property shortly after the U.S. invasion. The finance ministry officially reportedly told his wife shortly before he died that he'd received many threats from Chalabi, who warned, quote, "You will not stay for long. We will get rid of you." Chalabi has denied he threatened the man or had a role in the killing. He claims the allegation is part of an effect to remove him as head of the Iraqi Special Tribunal, which will try Saddam Hussein and other former leaders of the old regime. UPI is reporting U.S. forces arrested a leading Sunni Iraqi official shortly after he participated in a televised debate where he criticized the upcoming National Congress, which will meet in August. The arrested man was the press official for a prominent Sunni group that's called for a boycott of the Congress. According to UPI, four U.S. military vehicles intercepted his car and took him to an unknown destination. U.S. forces fought for hours yesterday with supporters of Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Members of Sadr's militia told Knight Ridder News Agency U.S. troops surrounded the home of Sadr's late father in Najaf in an apparent attempt to arrest him. A firefight broke out that lasted several hours. At least one Iraqi was killed. U.S. officials denied the account, saying their soldiers had come under attack. On Saturday, U.S. soldiers arrested the head of Sadr's office in Karbala. The attack on Sadr's house comes as British reporter Robert Fisk warns that Iraq is on the verge of exploding. In his latest dispatch, Fisk warns that 700 Iraqis died in Baghdad in July, marking the deadliest month since the fall of Baghdad. Fisk writes that U.S.-appointed government controls only parts of Baghdad and that the unelected prime minister, Iyad Alawi, is little more than the mayor of Baghdad. The United Nations is warning a humanitarian crisis could break out in Basra, Iraq's second largest city, due to a massive shortage of drinking water at the peak of summer. Water levels are now lower than before the U.S. invasion and estimated to be around 40 to 60% of what is needed for Basra's 2 million people. The Sudanese government says it'll double the number of security forces in the western Darfur region to 12,000. This in response to the United Nations mandate requiring the Khartoum government to disarm the militias accused of widespread violence against non-Arab groups. The Sudanese military said yesterday that the UN resolution was a, quote, declaration of war. The National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty called yesterday for the governor of Alabama to seek clemency to James Hubbard, a 74-year-old man scheduled to be executed on Thursday. If executed, Hubbard will become the oldest person ever executed in Alabama and the oldest person executed in the United States for more than 60 years. Kuwait has banned Michael Moore's film Fahrenheit 9/11 because it violates a law that prohibits insulting friendly nations. One Kuwaiti official said the film, quote, insulted the Saudi royal family by saying they had common interests with the Bush family and that those interests contradicted the interests of the American people.
My eyes this morning.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In this election year, books and movies that take on the Bush administration are taking in a significant amount of money, many registering on the bestseller list. Now, the controversial publisher of Hustler magazine, Larry Flynt, has thrown his hat into the ring. He's got a new book, too. It's called Sex, Lies, and Politics, The Naked Truth. It's been said you don't test free speech through the words of those you agree with, that it's best tested through the words of those you don't agree with. For many people, Larry Flynt has defined that test. He's known for publishing an image of a woman being put through a meat grinder, for putting feminist icon Gloria Steinem on a wanted poster, and depicting women in a manner many people say is outright demeaning, that encourages violence against them. At the same time, Flynt is known as a fierce defender of free speech and the First Amendment. His personal victory at the Supreme Court defending the First Amendment is world-renowned, mostly due to the critically acclaimed Hollywood film, The People versus Larry Flynt. Well, we caught up with Larry Flynt recently. He had gone into radio studio in San Francisco, and we talked to him about his life. Larry Flynt has certainly paid a price for his outspokenness. He was shot, severely wounded by a white supremacist, and now gets around in a wheelchair. We talked to him about how he took on the U.S. Congress during the Clinton years.
Well, this is actually where the book starts, and it covers a six-year period of history that, although very bizarre, I think probably six of the most important years in the history of the nation. But how I got involved in the impeachment debacle was every night when I would go home, I'd turn on the TV, it was Bash Clinton night. But at the same time, the polls showed that 70% of the people felt that he should remain in office. And I thought, this is inherently unfair, it's undemocratic, and somebody's got to do something about this. So I took a ad out for $85,000 in the Washington Post, offering $1 million reward for any person that could substantiate that they'd had an illicit sexual affair with their congressman or senator. Well, we got quite a bit of results from that ad, but the first one to fall was Bob Livingston, who was Speaker-elect of the House, who was scheduled to take Newt Gingrich's place. And when he was forced to resign a couple of days later, he did an interview with the New York Times, and he referred to me as a bottom feeder. And the Times called me for a comment, and I said, yeah, that's right, but look what I found when I got down there.
Can you explain what the response was? I mean, how did you get information on Congressmember Livingston?
Well, you know, he first came out and said, I may have strayed from my family, but never with anybody that worked for me or a lobbyist. Well, our three primary sources was a lobbyist on Capitol Hill, an intern that worked for him, and a judge in his home district. So, you know, he was very careless, you know, in terms of what he was doing. And that's the way most of them are, that actually wind up getting caught. And, of course, in that web, we also got Henry Hyde and Dan Burton and Bob Barr and some others. But everybody accused me of going after the Republicans, but that seemed to be the people that we wind up getting. I don't know why, but, you know, the conventional wisdom in Washington is if there's a scandal, money's involved as a Republican, if his sex is a Democrat, but in actuality, it's the complete opposite. With Republicans, it's sex, and with Democrats, it's money.
What about Congressmember Bob Barr, who was one of the House managers of the impeachment of President Clinton?
Well, the reason why we went after Barr is, you know, he'd been on my list for a long time. He used to go up on the floor of Congress and say that abortion is equivalent to murder. And at the same time, he was taking his wife for an abortion and paid for it with his own personal check, all which we have evidence of. So that is the kind of hypocrisy that really tears at our democracy. And I'm not interested in exposing anyone's sex life just for the sake of doing it, but only if they take a public position contrary to the way they're living their private life, then I think they're fair game.
So what actually happened with Congressmember Barr?
Well, obviously, that's not... the fact that his wife had an abortion was not enough to get him in trouble with his congressional office, but we managed to get him defeated in Georgia because we turned over all of our investigative files to his opposition down there.
Did you actually pay people $1 million, like the ad said, for giving you information?
You bet we do. And for 30 years, I've had a reputation of if sources are reliable, I'll pay for the information. The mainstream media frowns on this, but, you know, they can maintain, you know, their pompous attitude and their... what I consider below average reporting on important issues, but we go straight to the heart of it.
In one sense, didn't you pave the way? Because mainstream media has paid for information in the past. I mean, you have the whole Jessica Lynch story now, finally, because it got tremendous exposure. Viacom had to own up to this, but what they were offering the young private who is at the heart of one of the Iraq invasion myths about what happened to her in Iraq, not that she was taken captive, but how she was freed. Viacom offered all sorts of gifts in terms of concerts from MTV, the whole Viacom empire, if she would do her interviews with CBS. Can you talk about your involvement with the Jessica Lynch story?
Well, I was approached with two soldiers from Camp Pendleton who... You know, had nude photographs of Jessica that was taken in Iraq, and they wanted to sell them to me for publication in Hustler. So I bought them outright, but I wanted to do some investigation first. And I couldn't believe the information that we was able to turn up that was completely opposite of the public image we had of her. First of all, you know, she was a victim. You know, it's not like, you know, Bob Livingston, he was no victim. But Jessica Lynch was actually a victim. And she admitted that all of her injuries were sustained from when her Humvee turned over. She never fired a shot from her gun because it jammed. She was taken to an Iraqi hospital where the doctors did everything they could to save her life. They even tried to return her to her unit. And the Army wouldn't take her because they needed more time to organize this dramatic Hollywood rescue, you know, with cameras rolling and the whole bit. They seen it as having their Joan of Arc, little female Rambo, so to speak. And the Defense Department didn't want to let go of that because they needed her to help sell their war in Iraq. So I chose not to publish the photographs after I understood the whole story, you know, of what happened.
We're talking to Larry Flint, controversial founder of Hustler magazine, has written the book Sex, Lies, and Politics, The Naked Truth. Not everything you do has to do with sex, like suing, Donald Rumsfeld and going back from there, taking on the tobacco industry, taking on President Reagan. Can you talk about some of these crusades you have undertaken and why you have?
We were anti-tobacco and crusading against the tobacco industry before it was even chic. And when Ronald Reagan invaded the tiny island of Grenada, you know, the press didn't have a clue. And I sued the Defense Department for us not having press access to Grenada. But, of course, the conflict was over there before the judge even had an opportunity to rule on it. So the suit became moot. But when we invaded Afghanistan, I did the same thing. Because when you looked at all those reports on the evening news and you seen those faces popping up over the map of Iraq, you got the impression that it was being covered well by the American press. But many of those correspondents were hundreds of miles away from areas that they were reporting on. So there was no press that was accompanying the soldiers on the battlefield. So we sued, but we made it much more comprehensive. We're saying that we have a First Amendment right to cover the war. If Americans are sending their sons and daughters to die in a war, they have a right to know how that war is being conducted. I mean, if Franklin Roosevelt had taken the attitude that George Bush had taken, you know, we wouldn't even have a History Channel today. You know, for posterity's sake, I think the conduct of a war, you know, needs to be recorded. But not only that, we do have that First Amendment right. Now, we lost in the initial trial court in Washington. We've lost in the circuit court, and we have just petitioned the Supreme Court for cert. We think we got a good shot at getting the court to hear this case because, first of all, no case like this has ever been before the Supreme Court or prior to this. And we also ask that it not be limited to a particular theater of war, like we listed as the press having a right to cover the war on terror. So if it breaks out in the Philippines or Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever it is, you know, the press can still be there with certain restrictions. They can't do anything that's going to jeopardize the troops or our national security or things of that nature, which was the same rules that they played by in World War II.
Larry Hustler, the controversial publisher of Hustler magazine. Larry Flint, the controversial publisher of Hustler magazine. He's written a new book. It's called Sex, Lies, and Politics, The Naked Truth. We'll come back with him in just a minute.
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. We're broadcasting on over 240 radio and TV stations around the country, Pacifica stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network's Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375 Link TV. We're talking to Larry Flint, the controversial publisher of Hustler magazine. He's written a new book. It's called Sex, Lies, and Politics, The Naked Truth. We caught up to him in a studio in San Francisco while I was here in New York, and I asked him to talk about taking on the Republicans in the 1990s during the Clinton years. He'd written a letter to Judge Kenneth Starr on September 22nd, 1998. I asked him to read the letter.
Well, I didn't write the letter to Ken Starr till after he had released the Starr Report to all the libraries and schools in America and made pornography more widespread than I've been able to do in 25 years. The letter starts, "Let me take this opportunity to thank you on behalf of all the employees of Hustler Magazine and LFP Inc. for your tireless work in producing the Starr Report. I have been impressed by the salacious and voyeuristic materials in your work. The quality and quantity of material you have assembled in your report contains more photographic references than those provided by Hustler Online Service this month. I have included a chart in this letter that confirms that fact. Given your exemplary work, I would like to enter into negotiations with you regarding full-time employment for Hustler Magazine and related services offered by LFP Inc. When you conclude your work at the Office of the Independent Counsel, you have broken historic grounds in disseminating pornography materials to a broader and more diverse community of Americans in the context you have helped to shape and alter long-held community standards regarding the acceptance of pornographic material. I congratulate you for having opened the doors for libraries and schools to pornographic literature. Those of us at Hustler need your assistance in extending the parameters of pornography to a wider community of adults. You have opened a new era in promoting explicit sexual materials. Your keen aptitude and relentless focus on disseminating pornographic materials is an inspiration to every employee at Hustler. Please let me know when you or any of your representatives can sit down with me and discuss if you are interested in making a valuable contribution to promoting the First Amendment through Hustler Magazine. As far as compensation and relocation issues are concerned, please do not be concerned. You are a valuable asset who needs to be well compensated." End of letter.
And you sign it, "Respectfully yours, Larry Flint." The response?
Well, obviously I didn't get a response. But I thought it's ironic, you know, this guy's supposed to be a Puritan, you know, and he's anti-pornographic in all aspects. And he, that report didn't have to leave Congress. I mean, the trial had concluded in the Senate. The president had been impeached in the House. What deliberate reason that he chose to mass circulate the Starr Report, you know, I have no idea. I have no idea what was motivating him.
Well, it's interesting to look at the Los Angeles Weekly report with the headline "Star Report More Pornographic Than Hustler Online Magazine, Yet It's Rated G and Has Been Released by the U.S. Congress," and then the press release that you put out based on the Weekly's article saying, according to a chart in the September 18th, 24th issue of LA Weekly, the number of graphic references to genitalia in Hustler Online Magazine is 44. The number of graphic references to genitalia in the Star Report is 69. Number of graphic references to genitalia coming into contact with tobacco products in Hustler Online Magazine is 0. In the Star Report, 9. Access restrictions to Hustler is adults only. Membership fee to the Star Report, no age verification or implied restrictions. Free download. Links. Hustler has link to Star Report. Star Report does not have a link to Hustler Online. LFP Inc. releases Hustler Online. The Congress of the United States of America released the Star Report. Hustler Online Magazine is rated XXX for adult content. Star Report is rated G for adult contact, for adult content. I'm reading from the press release of Hustler Magazine after the Star Report came out. This is contained in Sex, Lies, and Politics, The Naked Truth by Larry Flint, who's on the line with us right now from San Francisco. You also, when talking about hypocrisy, took on Jerry Falwell and George Bush. George Bush many years ago, more than 30 years ago. Can you talk about why?
Well, we ran an ad parody on Hustler, a Campari ad, where the individual talks about his first time, and it's supposed to be his first time of drinking Campari, but we kind of took some creative liberties and said this was about Jerry Falwell's first time, and it was with his mother in an outhouse in Virginia. Well, he came totally unglued, sued, lost at the trial court, lost at the circuit court, petitioned the Supreme Court for cert. Not one member of the mainstream media would even file a friend of the court brief with us because no one felt that the Supreme Court would hear the case, and not only that, none of them wanted to be associated with me. And the Supreme Court selected my case against Falwell, and they ruled a unanimous decision in my favor, stating that parody is protected speech. Justice Rehnquist, in writing the majority opinion, he says simply because government finds speech offensive gives them no right to suppress it. You know, that basically what they're saying, if libel exists, fine, you can collect on libel, but if the average person cannot take what is being said or written as being seriously, and it falls under the category of parody, and libel does not apply. So that's been an important decision for political cartoonists, for editorial writers, and, you know, that decision came down in 88, and if you go back in memory, and you like remember the Carson show, it was a great show. Johnny was very funny, but it was very tame. But after my court decision, now you look at Lindland Letterman and Saturday Night Live, and their skits and monologues are really on the cutting edge, things that they would have never done in the 80s, but they're now able to do it because of that court case I won.
Larry Flint, you write in your book, Sex, Lies, and Politics, about a different kind of gag rule. And this, well, started a few months after you put the million-dollar ad in the Washington Post and held news conferences talking about sexual hypocrisy in Washington. And it was a response that you got, a tip from a Houston lawyer. Can you go into it?
Yes, we got a tip that in 1971, George Bush, who was not married at that time, was had gotten a girl pregnant, and had sought an abortion for her. And we took this investigation very seriously. First of all, not because of the abortion, because I'm pro-choice, you know. He was a young man, was not married at the time, you know, who knows, was probably even pro-choice. I know he hasn't always been pro-life. When he was running for Congress in Georgia, he when asked about abortion, he said that should be left between the woman and her doctor. But Roe versus Wade was not the law of the land at the time. That didn't happen until 2 years later. So
he ran for Congress in Texas.
Yeah. So the reason why that investigation became so significant is because it just radiated hypocrisy into the presidential election, you know, because the religious right had jumped on his bandwagon, you know, and he was on this holier-than-thou morality kick, and I felt the investigation was worth following through. We spent several months on it. We located the woman, in fact, who had the abortion. We even located the doctor who performed it, or the hospital where it was performed. We talked to several of, matter of fact, about four of the girls. The girl who had the abortion, her girlfriends who were aware of the pregnancy and the subsequent abortion. So we had the story relatively, nailed down. But what happened? Just a few weeks before the election, the girl dropped out of sight. Well, my attorneys told me, you can't do anything with this story, because if she surfaces and says it didn't happen, you know, you got egg all over your face and you got a possible libel action. So our hands was tied. But it was interesting to see that a short time later, she turned up living in a $500,000 home in Corpus Christi, Texas. And we felt that was a long way from the $13,000 a year that she was making as a cocktail waitress. So I'm not saying that George Bush paid her off, but I'm saying if he didn't, some of his cronies did.
You tried to get a mainstream reporter to ask the question. Can you talk about your interactions with Robert Novak and what happened? What was the question you were asking for?
Well, no, I managed to get my point across on Crossfire, but they cut it off on CNN's website. But I went to other mainstream media figures. I'm no point in dropping their name here, but you know, you would readily know who all they are, who they are. They're on the major networks, and showed all the evidence that we had, and I said, I don't want you to run with the story. I said, what I want you to do, I said, you got people out on the stump with George Bush every day. Just ask him the question. Everybody refused to ask the question. So I confronted them with the fact that I said, hey, you ask about his drug use and you had no proof at all. And I said, I got all this proof here and you won't even ask him about the abortion. I really think what the issue was, that the election was so close that they didn't want to come out, you know, with a story like this or asking questions like this and risk, you know, tipping the election one way or the other. But it really was a sad day as far as mainstream news goes, because, you know, they should be able to ask any question they want to ask of a candidate that's running for public office.
What about the criticism, Larry Flynt, that you have profited for so many years off of the exploitation and degradation of women, like showing a woman in a meat grinder? Your response to that?
Well, most of the criticism comes from the radical feminist movement, who really only claim to fame is to urge a bunch of ugly women to march. But other than that, I haven't received criticism. I've had thousands of models pose for me. I have never had not one case where a model has said she felt she was exploited, or
but that the imagery. I'm surprised
demeaning.
I'm surprised you would say the radical feminist movement, the very same kind of words that people like Rush Limbaugh talk about when women are standing up and fighting for their rights.
Well, I support the women's movement, equal rights, equal pay, non-discrimination in the workplace, but I just can't convince myself that Andrea Dworkin and Gloria Steinem speak for the average woman in America. I talk to average women all the time. Most of the officers in my company are women, and I just don't see the connection. When I'm using the word feminism or radical, I'm talking about the fringe. I'm not really talking about the average American woman.
Let me read to you from something. This came out after the film about you, and Gloria Steinem wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times, and she said, unlike his film character, the real Mr. Flynt is hardly an unwavering advocate of free speech. Indeed, other feminists and I have been attacked in Hustler for using our First Amendment rights to protest pornography. In my case, that meant calling me dangerous and putting my picture on a most wanted poster. I was also depicted as the main character in a photo story that ended up in my sexual mutilation. Given the number of crimes that seem to imitate pornography, this kind of attack does tend to get your attention. And she says, so now I'm not grateful to Mr. Flynt. Gloria Steinem says, I'm not grateful to Mr. Flynt for protecting my freedom, as the film and its enthusiasts suggest I should be. No more than I would be to a racist or fascist publisher whose speech is protected by the Constitution. My question is, would men be portrayed as inviting, deserving, and even enjoying their own pain and degradation as women are in Mr. Flynt's life work? And she says, Gloria Steinem writes, suppose Mr. Flynt specialized in such images as a young African-American man trussed up like a deer and tied to the luggage rack of a white hunter's car, or a nude white man fed into a meat grinder. Those are some of the milder ways in which Hustler portrays women. Your response, Mr. Flynt?
Well, nothing that I'm going to say is going to change Gloria Steinem's attitude. She was very useful to the women's movement in the 60s, but she's remained very much in the 60s. I think she's out of touch, and as I said earlier, I don't think she's speaking for the average American woman.
But what if she is speaking for herself? What if she is speaking, she is just voicing her opinion on, would you have something like this, African-American splayed out with degrading images? That, I guess one of the questions is, you have taken on power your whole life, and the criticism of a number of feminists is that you reinforce the images of the powerful with these images of, for example, women being mutilated, like being put through a meat grinder.
No, you see, that is totally unfounded, misinterpreted to a to a very large degree. I mean, we have our own base of readership, and we do a lot of outrageous political and social satire and a lot of black humor. Some of it is offensive, but if the First Amendment gives me a right to do anything, it gives me the right to be offensive. And if Gloria Steinem is offensive, then she shouldn't read the magazine.
Larry Flint, controversial founder of Hustler magazine. His new book is called Sex, Lies, and Politics, The Naked Truth. You can read the full transcript online at democracynow.org, where he also describes the attempted assassination on him as he was going to court. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we look at the life of Big Black, Frank Big Black Smith. Stay with us.
I was fresh out of the service, it was back in 82. And I raised some cane when I come back to town. I left to be all I could be, come home without a clue. And I married Dawn and had to settle down. So I hired on at the prison, guess I always knew I would. Just like my dad and both my uncles done. And I've worked on every cell block now, and things are going good. But then they transferred me to Ellis Unit 1.
Steve Earle, Ellis Unit 1, here on Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Big Black died this weekend. His real name, Frank Smith. One of the prisoners who rose up, Attica, 1971. He was 71 years old when he died. The rebellion began September 9th, 1971, as a protest against jail conditions. It ended on September 13th, 5 days later, when then New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller called out the New York State troopers. They opened fire, killing 39 men, 29 of them prisoners. 88 people were critically wounded. After the shooting stopped, the authorities moved in. They beat and tortured prisoners. 90 of the surviving prisoners were seriously wounded, but were initially denied medical care. The state would originally claim all the guards had died at the hands of inmates. New York Times reported on its front page the throats of all the guards were slashed, but it was all lies. The guards had been shot dead during the raid. After the troopers took control of the prison, the torture began. For Big Black, that meant being forced to lie on a table while officers beat and burned him. He was also threatened with castration and death. In the aftermath of the uprising, Frank Big Black Smith became a paralegal and litigant in a lawsuit that became the longest lawsuit in the history of New York State. It lasted a quarter of a century, resulted in the state of New York being ordered to pay $12 million to the prisoners. In a moment, we'll be joined by Liz Fink and Daniel Myers, who were close friends of Frank Smith, as well as his lawyer and his colleague. They were lawyers for the Attica Brothers, Liz Fink, Attica Brothers Legal Defense, a mass defense organization established shortly after the killing. She began working there in 1974. But first, we're going to just play a clip from Ghosts of Attica. It's a film from Lumiere Production that was done for Court TV. The story is told by Big Black and Liz Fink, who served as the lead counsel for the former Attica prisoners in their civil rights case.
I heard a helicopter. The helicopter says, lay down, put your hands on your head, you would not be harmed. And I complied.
They had us boxed in, and they were shooting down at us.
I couldn't crawl. I literally couldn't crawl. An inmate said, this guy is bleeding, it's bleeding, and bleeding. I didn't know what he was referring to me.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, you gotta tell him that.
Well, just, you know, everywhere you looked around, all you seen was everything they came across. People laying all over now, all bleeding and bloody and stuff. You know, so everybody know now that it's real, that this is it. You know, they're here now. They're in the yard now. They got control.
State troopers just took their clubs and beat them down the stairs. Broke people's legs, hit them on the tibia and broke tibias. On their back, on their head, in their genitals, on their front. You know, wherever they could hit them, that's where they beat them.
I'm telling you, my name is being called. Where's Big Black? Where's Big Black? Get up, Black, get up. And he busts me with a nigger stick, pickaxe, and got a 38 in his hand. And I gets up, and he, bam, in my side, in my back, and made me run with my hand on my head over to the side. And before I got over there, two, three more correction officers with him now, and everybody's hitting me. And now they made me spread eagle on the table. Here I am laying down, looking up at the catwalk, and cigarettes and spit and shells after they shoot their gun, they're dropping them down on me. And I'm there with the football up under my chin. That football better stay there, because if it falls, you're going to die sooner than you expect to die. I'm not in charge now. You know, I'm back to their reality. They're gonna show the humiliation that they're doing to me, everybody in the yard. Here's your security chief. What do you gotta say about it now?
They got mad, wanted to teach the lesson to their third world population, and let all this evil go down. You have at least 88 people who are shot so severely that they need immediate surgery. There was absolutely no preparation made to treat the inmates. No blood, no plasma, no bandages, no fluids, no painkillers, no surgical, nothing. Nothing was done. L.D. Barkley was shot. The shot went through and it collapsed his lung. He couldn't get medical treatment. And he bled to death.
That was Liz Fink in the film Ghosts of Attica. Liz Fink joins us in our studio. Again, she was a lawyer who started with the Attica Brothers Legal Defense Mass Defense Organization in 1974. Danny Myers as well, longtime friend and colleague of Big Black, who died this weekend. As we talked just now, as the film was playing, we're trying to figure out how old Big Black really was when he died, 70 or 71. Danny Myers, why is this so hard to figure out?
Well, for me, he's his happy birthday, and it was April 1, 1933, and it wasn't until recently that there was any record of his actual date of birth. And for me, that was very significant because slaves in the United States had no recorded births. I was going back to the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, in which his opening chapter says he can only guess as to his date of birth. He could only guess as to the location, and in some instances, they could only guess as to their parents. Frank Smith was born in the fields of Bennettsville, South Carolina. His mother was picking cotton. And up until about a year or so ago, there was no record of his birth. And the other part of that that's so amazing and what made him so significant to us is that he was only one generation removed from slavery. His mother's family were slaves. His mother was an indentured servant, if you will, in the fields of the South and migrated to the North.
Liz Fink, can you talk about Big Black's significance, what happened to him in 1971 in Attica, and how you worked together over these years? It's hard to just call him one of the prisoners, because in fact he almost became your colleague as a lawyer working on the longest case in New York history.
He was my partner. Not only on the Attica Prison Rebellion, which we always did all those years, but we also practiced law together. And I would call him my partner, and he would somewhat get upset because he didn't have a degree. But I say he had a PhD in life. You know, all of us had PhDs in books, but he was smarter than the rest of us, and he transformed all of us, right? Because we had to deal with how smart he was and how brilliant he was in people and how much love he had for people and his ability to get people to love him and to get people out of difficult situations. And people recognized this, and that's why he was chosen to be head of security in D Yard during the 5 days, when his job was to make sure that everything went okay and to guard the negotiating team. And then he was selected out for the most significant of the torture. And he was kept on that table that you saw for 6 hours. He was burned with cigarettes. He was beaten at any number of
times. This was done
times,
by the New York State Police.
September, yes, by New York State Police, various county sheriffs, the Park Police.
On September 13th.
On September 13th.
1971.
And then he was indicted in 4 indictments. Because what happened was that rather than investigate the real criminals, which were the state police and the people who killed everybody and the correction officers who tortured everybody, they indicted 62 inmates on 42 indictments, the largest series of indictments in the history of the state of New York. And there were 6 trials, 5 acquittals, 1 conviction. Black was charged in 4 indictments, right? All those charges were dropped for lack of evidence, and there were these unbelievable hearings where people came up, testified how they had been forced to lie about him. And rather than let this unbelievable experience destroy him, right, he took it, and of course he had enormous residue from being tortured, but he took it to take the love and the feeling that he had for everybody and to have as his goal to make everybody see that Attica is all of us. That was his main thing, that the prisons are just society. They're another costume. If we do to people in prisons what they do to people in prison, it's just the same thing as happens out on the street.
We only have 15 seconds. The connection between Attica then and Iraq prison today, Danny Myers.
Well, he was very conscious of this. In my last visit in May of this year, he was aware of
15 seconds.
He was aware of the torture that was going on by U.S. forces in Iraq and was very upset and angered by it.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us, and I want to have a part two on this to talk about those intervening years from the uprising to today and what Big Black accomplished. I want to thank you both for being with us, Liz Fink and Danny Myers, attorneys who worked along with Big Black, part of the prison uprising at Attica that will go down in history. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shruf Hovdokadus, Anna Nagar, Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.